especially in Saudi Arabia, it's easy for you to feel like, you know, you can't stay silent and you want to talk, you want to express, and it's something normal. It's a, you know, a normal, you know, human aspect.
Omar Abdulaziz, a Saudi dissident living in Canada and a friend of the slain journalist Jamal Khashoggi, said in an exclusive interview to The Guardian that the FBI showed him a number of exposed accounts following the breach, including an account used by Saddam. When I met the FBI, they gave me a list, and I saw a couple of accounts that had been compromised, including @Sama17. I think more than one person has been jailed because of this. @Sama70 is the parody account Saddam used to run.
The internet has become an alternate battleground, essentially, both for governments and for their oppositions. And so it's quite possible that the Saudis have the technological capacity to go in and survey the various elements within the internet looking for people who might express, you know, opposition in words or in pictures.
Abdulrahman Al-Saddam's stiff sentence came after a long period of disappearance. His family didn't hear from him for 23 months. When his father saw him for the first time, Abdulrahman's health had deteriorated after months of being held in solitary confinement. Critics say enforced disappearance is a stock in trade of Riyadh when treating its opponents, a crime out of control.
If you look at what happened to Khashoggi, all right, the journalist, and now with Saddam, it seems quite clear that their thuggery, if you will, is quite open, because they don't think that there's anybody out there who can hold them responsible. And so I wouldn't give them the honor of calling them a government, actually. They're a dictatorship and they rule by force, and their leadership is insecure in that position, and so they overreact to criticism.
The arrest of Saddam is part of a larger attempt by the Crown Prince to establish its foothold in Saudi Arabia as the next king. The crackdowns have seen Saudi authorities arrest senior royals, activists, intellectuals, and clerics. Strangely enough, as a political satirist, Al-Saddam was tried in the so-called counterterrorism court, a clear message to those who turn their pens against the Saudi establishment. In fact, Mohammed bin Salman has over and over again proved that writing against the government is a crime that carries an automatic life sentence or so. Saddam's family say he faced a secret trial at the same court that had initially sentenced women's rights activists Hussein al-Hathloul to nearly 6 years in prison. Shortly after the trial, MENA Rights Group tweeted, "We're appalled to learn that Abdulrahman al-Saddam was sentenced to 20 years in prison and a 20-year travel ban after a sham trial before the Saudi Specialized Criminal Court. He has been detained arbitrarily for over 3 years and deprived of his own basic rights."
They're saying, look, we are your masters, and so you don't mess with us, because we will destroy you, and we will even destroy your reputation within Saudi culture or the Saudi population. Because we can label you a terrorist. Doesn't matter the victim matching up with any normal definition. We would just arbitrarily call you a terrorist, and you will go down in history as we tell you to go down. I mean, as we describe you. And so it's a warning, if you will, to others not to do this.
Al-Sudan's case is significant in another aspect. The heavy sentence came just as the Biden administration criticized Saudi Arabia for its poor human rights record. It shows that the Saudi de facto leader does not care much about what the world might think of his violations of human rights, and that the gruesome murder of Jamal Khashoggi was not just an accident, but the tip of the iceberg.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime forces are facing fresh condemnation from international human rights experts for their force against Palestinian protesters in occupied East Al-Quds that left hundreds injured and airstrikes into Gaza that killed dozens of people, including 9 children. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Andrea Germanis Ryder. This article is published under the heading Human Rights Experts Denounce Israeli Regime Violence and Confiscation of Homes in East Al-Quds as Violation of International Law. Stay tuned, please, for the details. Israeli regime forces are facing fresh condemnation from international human rights experts for their force against Palestinian protesters in occupied East Al-Quds that left hundreds injured and airstrikes into Gaza that killed dozens of people, including children. Also under scrutiny are Israeli regime's attempt evictions in Sheikh Jarrah, which would amount to war crimes, Amnesty International said recently. In his statement, the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights reiterated his plea for an end to the violence. The body appealed to the Israeli regime to respect international humanitarian law. Referring to the Israeli regime's strikes into densely populated Gaza, an area deemed by occupation critics an open-air prison, spokesperson for the High Commissioner Rupert Colville said any attack, including airstrikes, should be directed solely at military objectives, and all feasible precautions must be taken to avoid civilian death and injury and damage to civilian objectives. Israel must also refrain from punitive measures such as additional closures and restrictions that punish the entire civilian population of Gaza, he said. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society, which says it's been targeted as its attempts to provide aid to wounded worshippers and protesters, said that over 900 Palestinians were injured between May 7th and May 10th in East Al-Quds. The repression drew condemnation from United Nations human rights experts Michael Link and Balakrishnan Rajagopal. The recent scenes of Israeli police and security forces attacking large crowds of Palestinian residents and worshippers is only intensifying a deeply inflammatory atmosphere in the city. A militarized response to civilian protests against discriminatory practices only deepens social divisions. Respecting rights is the only path forward, Link, special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territory occupied since 1967, and Rajagopal, special rapporteur on adequate housing, said in a statement recently. Their statement also references the threatened evictions of Palestinian families from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah, which have elicited ongoing protests. An occupying power is prohibited from confiscating private property belonging to the protected population, and it must respect the body of existing laws which had governed the territory, unless it is absolutely necessary to alter them, said Link and Rajagopal. The forced transfer of the population under occupation is a grave breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which contributes to the coercive environment now prevailing in East Al-Quds as well. They continued, these evictions breach the right to adequate housing, a core human right in international law. Saleh Hijazi, deputy director for the West Asia North Africa region at Amnesty International, similarly condemned the Israeli regime's recent actions. The latest violence brings into sharp focus Israel's sustained campaign to expand illegal Israeli settlements and set up forced evictions of Palestinian residents, such as those in Sheikh Jarrah, to make way for Israeli settlers. These forced evictions are part of a continuing pattern in Sheikh Jarrah. They flagrantly violate international law and would amount to war crimes, said Hijazi. Nabil Accord, one of the residents of Sheikh Jarrah who is facing possible eviction, told Amnesty International that the Israeli regime's actions must prompt urgent action from the international community. Sheikh Jarrah is sending a message to the whole world, including the US Congress, the UK Parliament, the French Parliament, the EU Parliament, the International Criminal Court, that what is happening to us is a war crime, said Accord. It is not just an eviction, but a war crime. Remember that. I do not know why the entire world is watching what is happening and letting Israel get away with it, said Accord. It is time they stopped spoiling Israel. In the US, some members of Congress are calling for a shift in ongoing policies and practices in which the US continues to supply the Zionist regime unconditional military aid and defense the Israeli regime's lethal military actions as self-defense, while rejecting direct criticism of Israeli regime forces' deadly attacks on Palestinians and the ongoing illegal occupation. Those voices include Representatives Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, and Andrei Carson. In a joint statement condemning the attacks on worshippers at Al-Aqsa, the lawmakers said the threatened evictions are a direct violation of international law, the Geneva Convention, and basic human rights. They said, "We condemn all violence in this conflict. These acts only serve to advance the political goals of the powerful at the expense of the suffering of people." The lawmakers also denounced the lack of accountability for Israeli regime's wanton human rights abuses and continuing illegal seizures of Palestinian land in the face of mere lip service to a Palestinian state. "It is long past time we finally take action to protect Palestinian human rights and save lives," the trio said.
We the people.
U.S. support for Israel.
The U.S. has been giving the Israeli regime unwavering support from the get-go. Thus, Israel has no greater friend than the United States today. The U.S. has given Tel Aviv billions of dollars in foreign military aid to remain a most strategic ally to the Zionist regime. Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Mila Javan Maggi. In this episode, we will delve into decades of US abetment of Israel's brutal policies, not just against its neighbors, but across the region and even the rest of the world. And more importantly, whether or not that support is undergoing any shifts today. Thank you for watching We the People.
As a young girl visiting Palestine to see my grandparents and extended family, I watched as my mother had to go through dehumanizing checkpoints. I remember shaking with fear when checkpoints appeared in the small village of Beit Oren Foka, tanks and guns everywhere.
Washington's closeness to Tel Aviv has helped strengthen the U.S. presence in the West Asian region. The United States has stored military equipment in Israel since the early 1990s. Yet the unbreakable bond between Israel and the U.S. runs deeper than military aids and treaties.
Anyone who wants to contribute to the cause, anyone who wants to provide funds or any other kind of help is welcome. We love our friends, and we don't see why some people should feel uneasy about taking assistance or money from this or that friend.
The so-called State of Israel was established by the Israeli Declaration of Independence on 14th of May 1948. Israel was officially declared a state, setting off on a path to brutality towards the occupied lands, neighboring countries, and beyond. Today, Tel Aviv's atrocities have been acknowledged by almost every state in the world. Our first guest is Dr. Rabab Abdulhadi, a senior scholar and the director of Arab and Muslim Ethnicities and Diaspora Studies at San Francisco University. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you. Dr. Abdulhadi, first of all, how do you evaluate the U.S.-Israel relations throughout history and the unwavering support Washington has offered to Tel Aviv?
Historically, the United States has supported Israel. Since actually the foundation of the State of Israel in 1948, more successive U.S. administrations have increased support as they went along until the latest president, Trump, has actually not only supported Israel but went along unconditionally with every aspect of its colonialist, racist, and apartheid policies. So this has been going on, and it has gotten to a very alarming situation right now.
Many thanks for your insight, Dr. Abdulhadi.
The U.S. support for Israel does not only involve the U.S. government itself. A glance at the history of the West's support for the Israeli regime shows that the number of Christian evangelicals backing the Zionist agenda stands way above the actual Jews. Christian Zionism is a phenomenon of the past and the present, a false ancient obsession that still today gets to play a significant role in world politics, particularly inside establishments of superpowers such as the United Kingdom and the United States.
Christians have directly brought over 750,000 Jews to Israel. That it started with the Soviet or the Russian Jews. It continued with Ethiopian Jews, where we brought most of the Ethiopians. It continued with some of these lost tribes of B'nai Menashe from India. But today, we bring from 28 countries.
But making Jews go to lands that belong to Palestinians comes with a high cost for humanity. How can the Christian Zionists' Asian prophecies and their combination with power in Washington be justified, considering its impact on the reality of people's lives today? Abbas Hamida is with us to discuss that. He's a Palestinian activist and commentator. He's also the co-founder of Al-Awda, the Palestine Right to Return Coalition. Hello and welcome to the show.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Mr. Hamida, what is on the evangelicals' agenda?
The Christian Zionists have an agenda, you know, in occupied Palestine, more so probably than the Jewish Zionists. I mean, in my opinion, they're just being used. So they have that same colonial settler mentality where we see in Palestine, for example, Jews coming from anywhere around the world, in particular Europe, they come and build these illegal outposts, okay? They build these houses on the mountaintops right across the street from the Palestinian people. You know, these people are extremely delusioned. They believe in a fanatical style, an ISIS style, if you will, of religion.
Thanks for your insights. Stay with us.
Evangelicals began cultivating ties with Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu during his first stint as prime minister in the 1990s. Today, the Israeli premier is the evangelicals' rock star. But not all Israelis have that sense of trendline in the U.S. Instead, some fear the Christian Zionists' true missionary agenda, converting them.
I believe that evangelicals support Israel because they connect Israel to their faith. Their Bible is a Jewish Bible. Their Messiah is a Jewish Messiah. And it's a connection. It's a DNA that goes back to Sunday school and to their very being. It's a love affair, it's a romance with a nation that is connected to heaven and earth.
That has made Israelis, even those residing on illegal settlements, view evangelists as a threat to Jews, though the Christians may have just been dispatched to help them harvest grapes at their vineyards on the occupied Palestinian territories. So, how is the love-hate relationship going?
Christian Zionists are very much committed to the preservation of Israeli colonialism, racism, and apartheid, because they actually also have this belief that if they bring about the power of Israel, Israel is going to fall apart, and by the Israel's falling apart, that's going to bring up the Messiah. So actually they are interested, they are engaged and invested in the destruction of the Jewish people, if you will, inside Israel. The Zionists, the Jewish Zionist lobby, and non-Jewish, because it is not only Jews, and there are many, many Jews, growing number of Jews, who stand on the side of justice in for Palestine and join hand in hand with Palestinians in the struggle for justice for all, and also refuse to allow Israel to speak in their name. They don't want to be complicit in the crimes of Israel against the Palestinians.
The American Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, is another powerful entity pressuring Washington to pursue Israeli interests. Since money is what fuels American support for Israel, the pro-Israel lobbying behemoth has too much sway over American policy.
Founded more than 50 years ago to strengthen, protect, and promote the U.S.-Israel relationship, the Israeli lobby in the U.S. also makes sure that dissenting voices are not allowed to be heard by being branded as anti-Semitic. With the organization's strong encouragement, AIPAC's members keep endorsing or raising money to influence U.S. politics in favor of Israel. So what is AIPAC after in the U.S. political system?
AIPAC lobby in Washington, D.C. that continues to basically support the idea that Israel is somehow an ally to the United States because they share the same values, because it's a Judeo-Christian society. And as we know, that's all hogwash. Their main interest is, the United States' main interest is basically to have hegemony in the region and to dominate and to have their military powers inside the Middle East, you know, inside occupied Palestine. This way, it's part of their global domination period.
The main victims of Israel's vicious actions are indeed Palestinians. Decades of systematic crackdown by the occupying forces have taught Palestinian generations that resistance remains the sole method to nullify the regime's inhumane tactics.
Daily life under occupation has yielded a whole lot of troubles for the Palestinian people, which they have to deal with on a daily basis, while their sufferings are underreported. Many activists assert that it is time to pay more attention to resistance against the occupation of Palestine if the world is actually serious about ending the Israeli aggression in the region. Is there no two-state solution then?
Palestinians do not necessarily support what is called the two-state solution, nor is the two-state solution viable. It's not even viable. I mean, even if you want to say this is what you want, it doesn't really work. Israel has continued to take on more land and expropriate this. The other thing is that I think it's really important to understand that Palestinians as a colonized, marginalized, oppressed people should not have to have the responsibility to find solutions for the colonial power that's oppressing them. So on all counts, this is not what Palestinians want. Israel actually has consistently destroyed any possibilities. The United States has supported Israel.
One of the most brutal and obviously illegal actions that Israel has been taking is the construction of settlements in Palestinian lands. Thousands of Israelis live in settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds. This is while all Israeli settlements are illegal under international law as they're built on occupied land.
We have a terrorist haven that is getting more and more rockets shipped Iran and elsewhere.
Nick, what are your thoughts on how that played out during
the... Well, that exchange, you know, the full Israel-Palestinian exchange was, I thought, by far the most interesting moment of the debate. They actually, you know, it calmed down, they sort of talked to each other a little bit more, and Bernie Sanders laid out pretty clearly a position I have not seen any politician lay out on national stage ever, which is to say, look, there is a conflict, and really, our sympathies have to be a heck of a lot more with the Palestinians.
The international community has repeatedly opposed Israel's settlement activities, urging U.S. President Biden to put pressure on Israel over the issue. In the meanwhile, Israel keeps approving plans for more settler homes. Is it wishful thinking to somehow expect U.S. policymakers to make a positive change?
I mean, we would like to see change through Congress in the United States. We would like to see, you know, mainstream politics go ahead and leaders getting involved. We would love that. We would love for there to be a real workable solution where the refugees can come back under UN Resolution 194, which grants the Palestinian refugees all around the world the right to return to their homes. Okay, that's my main activism here in the United States, is to push for that. But in all reality, what I see is that this illegal Zionist entity is heading towards self-destruction. You know, unfortunately, they venture and some of these maneuvers that will one day, you know, end the Zionist program in Palestine.
Many in the United States question the levels of aid and general commitment to Israel. But those behind the curtain feel confident that the U.S. relations with Israel strengthen the U.S. presence in West Asia. But according to some polls, the nation is relatively divided about Washington's policies towards Tel Aviv.
They do not believe that there should be a constant incitement by Hamas, aided and abetted by Iran, against Israel.
I don't think that anybody would suggest that Israel invites or welcomes missiles
flying into their country. That is not the issue. And you evaded the answer. You evaded the question. The question is not does Israel have a right to respond, not does Israel have a right to go after terrorists and destroy terrorism. That's not the debate. Was their response disproportionate? I believe that it was. You have not answered that.
Israel is more popular among older Americans, Republicans, conservatives, and evangelicals, and less popular among liberals, African Americans, and Democrats. Regardless of its public image in the US, Israel has an immense economic power with more companies listed on the NASDAQ than any other country outside North America. Is it any different with Democrats in power today?
I think the only way the new President Biden's administration is as far as occupied Palestine goes is lip service. The Democrats are better at deceiving the world. They're better at deceiving their own citizens by offering lip service about Palestine. You know, saying we want to get back to the table, we want to do this, and we want to. So, in other words, getting back to the table is still the same situation, it's still the same policy, because going back to the table is just delaying time, you know, for the Palestinian people. There's an occupation that needs to end. The settlements must be dismantled. There's a long list of Palestinian refugees, as you know, languishing all over the world, over 7.2 internally and externally, million Palestinians, 7.2 million, who wish to go back to their original towns and homelands in Palestine. And I happen to be one of them in the United States.
The Zionist regime was emboldened to new heights during the administration of former President Trump. The billionaire businessman who was controlled in part by the Christian Zionists and the Jewish lobby in America served Tel Aviv like no U.S. presidents before him. He moved the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem al-Quds, a holy city that Palestinians consider the capital of their future state.
It is time to officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Israel is a sovereign nation with the right, like every other sovereign nation, to determine its own capital. It was 70 years ago that the United States, under President Truman, recognized the State of Israel. Ever since then, Israel has made its capital in the city of Jerusalem.
Unlike former presidents, Trump recognized the city as the Israeli capital, despite international outcry. The U.S. moved on and officially recognized Syria's Golan Heights to the regime's territory as well, although it had already been occupied for many years.
The United States is an interventionist power. The United States is very much interested in continuing to be intervening in the region. In that sense, Israel actually is quite the relationship with Israel. And I wouldn't say that the United States is sort of like the Israel is not only a base for the U.S., Israel is a junior partner. They both want to control the oil of the region. They want to control the region, which is a very strategic place. They want to be able to suppress any kind of possibilities for movements. They already participated both in Arab regimes' support for the counter-revolutions in the Arab world.
Many thanks. Stay with us as we have more for you.
The administration under President Joe Biden has pledged to change course in the Israel-Palestinian conflict. During his 2020 presidential election campaign, Biden reiterated his proclivity for a so-called two-state solution. The U.S.-Israel relations have also been at odds, at least on the surface, over the Biden administration's stated efforts to return Washington to the Iran nuclear deal, which Trump quit.
Remember here, Biden is very pro-Israel. I don't think that we can, you know, sugarcoat the reality that although there was a very tense relationship between Netanyahu and Obama, Biden has always had a very good relationship with the Israelis and with Netanyahu, generally speaking. That's not going to be reversed. And frankly, I'm sure there may be some elements of the progressive party of the Democrats who want to see that reversed. But the majority of the Senate will be Republican. And I think there's just no appetite to do something like reversing the embassy decision. On the JCPOA, I think there is definitely going to be an interest to go back to some sort of multilateral negotiations, which the JCPOA was. The challenge, of course, is that the world isn't the same as it was when it was negotiated in 2015.
In reality, Biden is being similarly controlled by the regime's powerful lobbies pursuing the Zionist agenda inside the United States.
The pro-Israel U.S. media at times portrays Biden's relations with Israel as less cozy compared to previous American leaders. But his administration intends to build on some of Trump's one-sided policies in the region. Unlike Barack Obama and Donald Trump, Biden has not named a special envoy to focus on the Israeli-Palestinian portfolio.
Hundreds of delegates to the Democratic National Convention have asked Biden to get rid of a few pro-Israeli strategic people on his staff for his campaign, and Blinken was one of them. So that's one thing. The secondly is that Biden has also said that they're going to continue the same U.S. policy towards Israel by centering what they call Israeli security without actually giving any attention to Palestinian security, Palestinian safety. Palestinians are the ones who are occupied, who are colonized, who are displaced, who are uprooted. They are the ones who need security. It's not Israel who's like, what, the fourth or the fifth strongest army in the world. It doesn't really need that. Israel presents the argument for security in order to deflect from the real issues at stake, which is Israel's racism, colonialism, occupation, the displacement of Palestinians, the refusal to allow Palestinians to return. So now the United States government says that this is what they support. As far as these are one of the main anchors of their policy towards Israel, they have restored some of the things that Trump taken away. So they restored U.S. funding towards UNRWA, United Nations Relief and Work Agency.
Biden has so far adopted a passive role in dealing with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, unlike most of his recent predecessors. He has no plans for any sort of peace conference or even a peace process anytime soon. Yet, his initial resistance in engaging with the issue could eventually change, making him unable to totally ignore it.
Look, you're all united. We're all united by our unyielding, and I mean it literally, unyielding commitment to the survival, security, and success of the Jewish state of Israel. But what impresses me most is what I know those of you who've been with AIPAC a long while understand is the lifeblood and the certainty and security. And that is the more than 4,000 young people you have here. Would all the young people who are here stand up if it's your first? I want to see you.
That was the former vice president. With Biden in the White House again, Trump's heavily pro-Israel tilt has been replaced with reluctance to wade into the conflict for now.
Even if the U.S. shows more interest in dealing with conflict, Palestinians have already lost their hope and trust in the United States' baseless claims of pursuing peace. It is therefore unlikely for the U.S. to change course in regards to Israel and its atrocities. I'm your host, Mila Jawamardi.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The comparison of the number of doses of vaccines manufactured by the rich countries with the number of doses used by them in their own countries provides a clear picture of the extent of vaccine apartheid practiced by these countries. An article published in the New York Times in late March reveals residents of wealthy and middle-income countries have received about 90% of the nearly 400 million vaccines delivered so far. We now present you a two-part article written by Prabir Purkayasla, the founding editor of Newsclick.in, a digital media platform. The piece is titled, The West Practicing Vaccine Apartheid at a Global Level. More than an eighth of the world's population living in rich countries, the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, and the European Union have access to more than 50% of the world's COVID-19 vaccine doses. According to Our World in Data, about 112 million people in the United States alone received at least a single inoculation by 8th of April. This is more than 12 times the total number of people vaccinated in the entire continent of Africa, which has four times the population of the United States. On 8th of April, the World Health Organization WHO said that nearly 13 million of the 31.6 million doses delivered so far to 45 African countries have been administered. And if we do not count the vaccine doses that have been administered in Morocco, truly an outlier in Africa, as of 8th of April, the United States has received almost 35 times the vaccine doses that Africa has. No wonder Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, the World Health Organization's Director General, called the distribution of vaccines grotesque and a catastrophic moral failure. Let us not call reserving the bulk of vaccines for a handful of rich ex-colonial or settler colonial states vaccine nationalism. Let us call it what it is. Vaccine apartheid at a global level. How much of the COVID-19 vaccine manufactured in the rich countries has gone to the rest of the world? The answer is that the rich countries have kept their supplies almost entirely to themselves. Moderna's vaccine production has mostly been used to inoculate the population in the United States, besides supplying it to some countries in Europe and also to Canada. Pfizer has supplied its vaccines to the United States from its U.S. facilities, and to Europe and to the United Kingdom from its European plants. It has also supplied vaccines to the occupied Palestine and the Persian Gulf monarchies, and begrudgingly parts of Latin America, but that makes up a small fraction of its total production. The rich countries have had some squabbles with one another over vaccine supplies. An example of this is the clash between the European Union and the pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca and the United Kingdom. Perhaps this is why they have had no time to think about the rest of the world. A comparison of the number of doses manufactured by the rich countries with the number of doses used by them in their own countries provides a clear picture of the extent of vaccine apartheid practiced by these countries. An article published in the New York Times in late March reveals residents of wealthy and middle-income countries have received about 90% of the nearly 400 million vaccines delivered so far. Where has the rest of the world gotten its vaccines from? It appears that the only other sources of vaccine for low- and middle-income countries are those being produced by China and India, with Russia providing smaller amounts of vaccines. This is substantiated by various press sources that recount how countries in Latin America, Eastern Europe, Africa, and Southeast Asia are receiving supplies from China, India, or Russia. How much of the vaccine supplies from Sinovac, a Beijing-based biopharmaceutical company, and Sinopharm, a Chinese state-owned company, was administered locally in China, and how much has been provided to the rest of the world? According to a 5th of April article in Nikkei Asia, which relied on data provided by Air Infinity, an analytics company, about 115 million doses of the vaccine have been used in China, and the same amount has gone to the rest of the world. Similarly, based on the figures released by India's Ministry of External Affairs website on 15th of April, more than 65 million doses of the vaccine produced by the Serum Institute's Covishield vaccine licensed from AstraZeneca have been exported to other countries. With the surge in the rate of infection in India recently, the doses exported from that country have fallen in comparison with the number of vaccine doses it has administered to its own population. According to a 13th of April article in Deutsche Welle, more than 104.5 million people in India have received at least one dose of the inoculation, whilst India has shipped more than 60 million doses of the vaccine to 76 nations. China, India, and Russia are the only three major countries that have been willing to export vaccines whilst also vaccinating their own populations. To curtail the sharp rise of COVID-19 cases in India, the country is currently prioritizing its supplies and has temporarily halted exports of vaccines from India. This has slowed down vaccine supplies to other countries significantly, particularly in March and April, and will impact the COVAX program, particularly in Africa, which is heavily dependent on the World Health Organization's Access to COVID-19 Tools, or ACT, Accelerator Program and its vaccine pillar of COVAX. The Sputnik V, developed by the highly respected Gamaleya National Center of Epidemiology, has shown its efficacy in clinical trials. However, ramping up its production has been slow. Russia's production capacity of vaccines is not on the same scale as Indian and Chinese manufacturers. While many Indian and South Korean companies have expressed interest in manufacturing the Sputnik V, they have yet to start doing so. Only one South Korean company, Hankook Chorus Farm, has started production of Sputnik V, and a large consortium of South Korean companies has signed up to manufacture 500 million doses. Five Indian companies, Hetero Biopharma, Gland Pharma, Stelis Biopharma, Virchow Biotech, and Panacea Biotech, have inked deals with the Russian Direct Investment Fund, or RDIF, for setting up a combined production capacity of 850 million doses. Meanwhile, even as India looks to ramp up its current vaccine production to meet the worldwide demand, it has not been able to do so. The Serum Institute of India, the largest vaccine manufacturer in the world, can produce up to 100 million Covishield doses per month and can add to that capacity with additional investments. Similarly, Biological E, which is expected to produce 600 million doses of Johnson & Johnson's single-shot vaccine after recent approvals by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, has not been able to begin production. This raises questions about what is preventing these companies from expanding and producing vaccines. This is where the global media, read the dominant Western media, fail to inform people about the bottlenecks against ramping up production around the world. Apart from the intellectual property rights issue, the major roadblock to quickly ramping up global vaccine production is that the rich countries such as the United States, the European Union, and Britain have been refusing to export not only vaccines but also supplies of intermediate products and raw materials required for vaccine production in other countries. The United States is using a 1950 Korean War vintage Defense Production Act to curb export of vaccines as well as raw materials and other inputs vital for vaccine production elsewhere. According to an article in Mint Press, in a letter to Indian Commerce Secretary Anup Wadhawan and Foreign Secretary Harsh Vardhan Singla, Prakash Kumar Singh of the Serum Institute wrote that by invoking the Defense Production Act, the United States is making it difficult to import necessary products like cell culture medias, raw material, single-use tubing assemblies, and some specialty chemicals to India. The U.S. restrictions, which prioritize Moderna's and Pfizer's vaccine production, harm not only the Serum Institute's Covishield production, but also its efforts to produce another 1 billion doses of Novavax. According to an article published in the Financial Times, Adar Poonawalla, the chief executive of the Serum Institute of India, told a World Bank panel recently, he said, "The Novavax vaccine, which we're a major manufacturer for, needs these raw materials and items from the United States. We're talking about having free global access to vaccines, but if we can't get the raw materials out of the United States, that's going to be a serious limiting factor." Similarly, Mahima Dattla, managing director of Biological E, which is committed to making Johnson & Johnson's single-dose vaccine in India, voiced concern about the US embargo on vital intermediate products and supplies. In an interview with the Financial Times, she said materials that are a vital part of vaccine production are made only by a limited number of companies that are under the US embargo. Unless the global supply chain is viewed in its entirety and not with the me-first approach of the United States and the other rich countries, it will not be possible to control the coronavirus pandemic. The Indian government, which looked quite willing to be the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue's COVID-19 vaccine supplier, as also seen from the joint statement by Quad leaders, the spirit of the Quad seems to have backed off from any public engagement with the US government on this count. There has been no public response by New Delhi relating to the plea of the big Indian generic manufacturers on how to facilitate both capital and the much-needed supplies for rapidly increasing production. Instead, the Indian government has slowed down its export of vaccines to other countries, worsening the global crisis. The other part of the ugly picture of vaccine apartheid is the vicious campaign mounted against the Chinese and Russian vaccines. It is bad enough that the United States and its allies are not willing to share the vaccine they produce with the rest of the world. Moderna and Pfizer vaccines are not available to most low- and middle-income countries. And even if they were available, these countries will not be able to provide the ultra-cold chain infrastructure required by these mRNA vaccines. An anti-China and anti-Russia campaign by Western media means that they are willing to deny the global population of any vaccine, even if this means taking on the risk of new variants of the virus emerging and the permanent threat of COVID-19 looming large across the world. The latest in this anti-China campaign is twisting the statement of Gao Fu, the head of the Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Gao Fu suggested improving the efficacy of the vaccines being produced by China by mixing them. This is being touted as a rare admission of weakness and proof of the poor quality of the Chinese vaccines. How are similar statements by AstraZeneca of using Sputnik V as the second dose, along with a first dose of AstraZeneca, not viewed in the same light? The figures to show more than 90% efficacy for Moderna and Pfizer and about 62% for Oxford AstraZeneca, compared with supposedly only about 50% efficacy for the Sinovac vaccine, do not reflect a true comparison. In clinical trials in Turkey and Indonesia, the figures for Sinovac's vaccine were 83.5% and 65.3% respectively. The low figure of 50.4% in the Brazilian trial was a result of counting very mild symptoms as positive cases, which other vaccine trials did not count. According to an article in Bloomberg, data from Brazil's Sinovac CoronaVac trials showed that it provided 78% protection in mild cases and 100% protection in moderate and severe cases. Esper Callas of the School of Medicine, University of Sao Paulo in Brazil, pointed out in an article in Science magazine, "If you can prevent someone being seen by a doctor by 78% and prevent hospital admissions by 100%, let's give a toast and celebrate." The good news is that Sinovac's vaccine is maintaining its efficacy against the more transmissible and dangerous Brazilian P1 variant at more than 50%. AstraZeneca's vaccine has low efficacy of just 10.4% against the B1351 prevalent currently in South Africa, although it was more effective against the B117 variant, otherwise known as the UK variant. I have earlier reported about the World Trade Organization WTO rules and the rich countries' unwillingness to suspend IPR rules temporarily so that all the vaccine producers can re-engineer their facilities very quickly to produce COVID-19 vaccines. In the books of the rich countries, the tens of billions of dollars to be earned as profits in the vaccine market by Big Pharma far outweigh the benefits of saving millions of lives. This also explains the vicious campaign against Chinese and Russian vaccines. For Big Pharma and for the rich countries, it is profit over lives every time. Whether it was during the AIDS epidemic earlier or with the COVID-19 pandemic now. Vaccine apartheid and support for Big Pharma are driving the policies of the rich countries. It does not matter that these policies will perpetuate the continuation of the global pandemic and the emergence of new variants of the coronavirus, along with the economic crisis being faced by most nations. Only a powerful movement for people's health and universal vaccines can beat back the offensive by Big Pharma, coupled with the ongoing vaccine apartheid by the rich countries. Well, dear listeners, that was a second and concluding part of Prabir Prukayasa's article, "The West Practicing Vaccine Apartheid at a Global Level." Till next time, take care and goodbye.